This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
Our topic today, the latest twists and turns in health reform. Our guests, Tim Jost and Paul Martin. In case you haven't met them before, Tim is a health law specialist who's become one of the go-to guys for the national media on both the politics of reform and explaining the ins and outs of what's officially called the Affordable Care Act. He's also authored a book examining how health policies in other parts of the world compare to the U.S. And Paul, well, he's been a public policy specialist at the Batten School for some time, but just recently began forming a citizen action group that's working to help people prepare for coming changes in health law. So if you've got questions about what's up next from what some refer to as Obamacare, Tim and Paul would be the guys to talk to, and you can, right after the news.
Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Tim Jost is a health law specialist and a professor of law at Washington and Lee University. Paul Martin is a faculty member in the University of Virginia's Batten School of Public Policy, as well as one of the founding members of a new public service operation that calls itself the Greater Charlottesville Community Health Coalition. Gentlemen, thank you both for making time for us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Appreciate the invitation.
Well, so to you who are listening, if you've got questions about the latest wrinkles in healthcare reform or observations to share, we'd love to hear your voice on one of our phone lines, which can be reached at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. But Tim Jost, let me go to you first. Could you give us an overview of where we are with those parts of federal health care reform that have already gone into effect and what's coming up next?
Okay. Well, the federal health care law, parts of it went into effect back in 2010, and it has already had a significant effect. I actually just got a release this morning from a couple of congressional committees. And this information is specific to the 6th Congressional District, Bob Goodlatte's district, stretching from Harrisonburg down to Roanoke. But in that district, and I think there'd be comparable statistics for the other districts you cover, 7,000 young adults now have health insurance through their parents' plan. And that includes my son, who's 24 years old and has a chronic disease and I think would otherwise be uninsurable. More than 10,600 seniors in the 6th District received prescription drug discounts worth $15 million, averaging about $620 so far in 2013. Over 60,300 consumers in the district received approximately $4.8 million in insurance rebates in 2011 and 2012 because insurance companies are now required to spend 80% of their premiums on health care instead of on overhead. In October 1 of this year, the exchanges are going to open their doors, and up to 95,000 individuals in the 6th District who are currently uninsured will have access to federal premium tax credits to help them purchase insurance, in addition to 45,000 individuals who already purchase insurance in the individual and small group markets, who will have access to better coverage and premium tax credits, many of them. So a lot has happened already, and a lot is about ready to happen when the law finally goes fully into effect on January 1st of 2014.
One of the newest wrinkles is a portion of what it meant to go fully into effect at the beginning of next year, Tim Jost, has now been delayed?
That's correct. The employer mandate, what's it's called is the employer shared responsibility provision, was supposed to go into effect on January 1st, 2014. And what was supposed to happen, I mean, basically in our country, most adults are covered through their employment. And that's been true since the 1950s. And that's what's going to continue to be the case. The CBO estimates that, in fact, the number of people covered by employer coverage will continue to grow. But just to make sure that we continue to have a strong employer coverage in this country, The Affordable Care Act said that if you are a large employer, it doesn't apply to small employers, but if you're a large employer and if you don't insure your employees, and if one of them ends up going into the exchange and getting federal premium tax credits, essentially if you end up freeloading on the taxpayers to cover your employees, then you're going to have to pay a penalty. Well, that the employers and insurers were supposed to file reports at the end of 2014 so that the IRS could figure out whether they had been covering their employees or not. It turned out that those reports turned out to be pretty complicated, and the businesses were really complaining about that, and the administration decided we could wait a year for that. But having delayed the reports, it also is going to delay the employer mandate for a year.
When you say, Tim Jost, large employers, do I understand correctly that this is a workplace that employs 50 people or more?
50 people or more, but that includes full-time employees and full-time equivalent employees. But in that range, 50 employers with 50 or more employees, about, I think it's over 95% now do insure their employees. So there weren't that many employers who were going to be affected by this. And the effect was really more looking toward the long term, that employers not be tempted to drop insurance that we're already offering it.
So, Paul Martin, the basic question we're starting with is an overview of what's already gone into effect and what is coming that is going to be affecting people. What would you like to add?
I think the big thing that we need to pay a lot of attention to is that the marketplaces, which we are now calling what had been referred to as the exchanges, the new language is the marketplace. We sense that that's easier for folks to understand and to think about. That's going to open up on October 1st. People will have to have health insurance by January 1st, and so we have a very tight window where we'll be needing to enroll people. In Virginia, because the state decided to delay or perhaps not expand Medicaid, which was the piece of the health insurance law that was intended to cover folks who were very poor, folks who earned up to about 138% of the poverty line, the state of Virginia is delaying that. We might expand Medicaid next summer, but I think politically that's still up in the air. My colleague can talk a little bit more about that. But what it's going to mean in the short run is that where there was three pieces of this policy that was going to help those folks who are uninsured, it was all intended to take place effectively by the end of this year. We're delaying the employer mandate piece by a year. The state of Virginia is delaying Medicaid expansion, whereas if you lived in California, Medicaid expansion goes forward right on time. So what we're left with is the third piece, which is the marketplaces, which are really designed to help people who are in the earning, who don't have health insurance and are making above 100% of the poverty line.
Paul, those marketplaces that you're talking about are sometimes referred to, although I guess this is becoming politically incorrect, as healthcare exchanges.
I don't know if it's a matter of being politically incorrect. It was just a matter of trying to come up with language that was better understood by people. And a marketplace is someplace where you buy something.
But these are federally mandated, whatever it is.
That's correct.
A marketplace, an exchange, a place where if you don't have insurance, you can go and look for what's supposed to be reduced cost insurance. Is that right, Tim
Jost?
Well,
for most people, what this is going to be is a website. And they'll be able to go to that website just like you go to a travel website or a shopping website now. And you'll be able to compare plans side by side and decide which plan is best for you, and you'll be able to then enroll in premium tax credits that will pay for part of the cost if your income is below 400% of the poverty level. So that's, and then there will also be call centers. There will be trained individuals called navigators or consumers. Well, not in Virginia. It'll be navigators or enrollment counselors who will be there to help people figure this out. And of course, agents and brokers will continue to do this as they always have. So there'll be lots of help for people to figure this out. But the basic idea is that there will be plans that, number one, all cover the essential health benefits, 10 essential health benefits that all of us should have. And secondly, that cost sharing will be comparable. So you'll know that if you want a high deductible plan, you can get a bronze plan. If you want a plan that covers almost everything, you can get a gold plan, but you can compare one plan to another plan and decide which plan is the best plan for you.
One of the things that we didn't talk about is that when the law went into effect, one of the big pieces of it was to create some standards within the insurance that's being offered to folks. We won't have a situation that we have now where you can be offered insurance through your employer that is virtually worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Once the marketplaces open up, the insurances that are in that online marketplace mm-hmm. available to you meet a pretty significant threshold for care.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mean, I was waving at the producer.
Ah, okay.
I wasn't trying to stop. You were
making the cutoff noise.
I knew I was going to cough, and so he was supposed to help me not
okay.
cough in people's ear. But as long as we pause, for the sake of anybody who's just recently joined us, let us mention that our guests, Tim Jost, attorney and professor of health law at Washington and Lee University, as well as Paul Martin, political scientist and faculty member in the University of Virginia's Batten School of Public Policy. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Just a second, Tim. I also want to encourage anybody who has questions, comments, opinions to share, worries about what's going on with the new federal health care changes. We'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Tim Jost.
Yeah, I'd like to say a little bit more about the Medicaid expansion piece because that's really important. The way in which Congress conceived of this was that people whose incomes were below 100% of poverty, which for an individual is about $11,500, for a family of four, $23,500, that people in that range could really not afford health insurance. And so the statute was going to expand Medicaid to cover all those people.
And before you go on, let me see if, because I know that I spend a lot of time reporting on this kind uh-huh. of stuff, and I don't understand it. So there's a fair chance that there might be somebody else listening who's mm-hmm. a little hesitant in their mm-hmm. understanding. It's my impression, Tim Jost, that every state has different standards about who qualifies for Medicaid, at least to some degree.
Yeah, that's
and
correct.
And that in Virginia, our standards are such that on a per capita basis, we give out, some people who have called it stingy, but we're quite low in how much we give out compared to other states. I think we're ranked something like 48th in the nation.
That's possible. We are very low. Let me just say, in Virginia, and this is true in most states, prior to 2014, if you are an adult who is not pregnant, is not over 65, is not disabled, and is not a parent, you're not eligible for anything in Medicaid.
So the assumption that many people have is that Medicaid is already taking care
yeah.
of poor people
yeah.
is not accurate.
That is not true. Also, even if you're a parent, the level is very low. I forget what it is exactly, but something like 28-30%, something like that. So it was supposed to go up to 138% of poverty, and no provision was made for people under 100% of poverty. And the federal government was going to pick up 100% of the tab for the first 3 years, and then after that it would phase down to 90%.
And let me again interrupt to make sure I'm tracking you. Under the Affordable Care Act that many people now refer to as Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
Part of the idea of how to get all of the poor covered was that states were going to be required to, along the lines that you just mentioned, expand Medicaid to cover many more poor people under Medicaid.
That's correct.
But because of a Supreme Court decision in part, states did not have to do that. They get to opt out of doing that. Virginia, so far, is one of those states that has opted out of accepting those extra federal dollars that would pay for the expansion. Is that correct?
That's correct, but Virginia is doing that at a very high cost, and maybe we can talk about that more.
Well, that sounds like such a good idea. We also have some calls coming in, so we're going to continue our conversation here with health care specialist Tim Jost and public policy specialist Paul Martin, and maybe you, if you give us a call at 888-967-2825.
Ham in Stanton is going to be our first caller when we get back, and that'll be a bit more than 1 minute. Paul Martin is Director of Professional Development at the Batten School of Public Policy within the University of Virginia. He is also one of the founding members of a new public service organization that calls itself the Greater Charlottesville Community Health Coalition. Tim Jost is co-author of the book Health Law, one of the most frequently used textbooks on that subject. His most recent book for a lay audience analyzes healthcare systems in other parts of the world compared to what we have here in the U.S., and it is titled Healthcare at Risk. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. As you can probably tell, even if you've just joined us from the credentials of our guests, we're looking at the latest twists and turns on healthcare reform. And Ham in Stanton, we were going to take your call, but I'm not sure what happened to your line. Maybe there was a little cell phone problem there. If you want to call us back, please feel free. But we do have Nancy in Harrisonburg holding on. Nancy, thanks for doing that. Your question or comment, please.
Well, I wondered if your guest would like to comment on Time Magazine's special report in March of this year. The whole issue was devoted to medical costs, hospital costs, and executive pay. For example, one example they gave was that hospitals have sometimes more profit than they need, so they're building other hospitals which aren't needed. So I wondered if they had read this report and had any comments.
This is Tim. If I could comment quickly, we have the most expensive healthcare in the system in the world by far, far more than what other countries spend on healthcare. I saw an analysis recently that if you look back, I think it was 30 years, and take the amount of money that we spend in the United States in excess of what Switzerland, which is the second most expensive country in the world, spends, we could have done various things like send 100 and I think it was 170 some million college students to college for 4 years for free, covered all of South Carolina with solar panels. We would have, I think, a $3 trillion surplus instead of the deficit we now have. So we do spend a great deal more than other countries do, and a lot of that goes for spending on hospitals. I think part of the reason for that is that we really don't have either a well-regulated healthcare system or a market-driven healthcare system. And one of the things that the Affordable Care Act attempts to do is to set up competition among health insurers so that when you go to the exchange, they're going to be competing with each other on price rather than by trying to keep people out of the system that are unhealthy. And in turn, those health insurers are then going to have to make providers compete with each other on price. And the hope is that that will bring down health insurance costs. But I should say that in the last 3 years, we have, since the Affordable Care Act was enacted, and I don't know that there's an exact correlation, a lot of people are thinking about that, we've seen the lowest growth in healthcare costs at any time, probably in my lifetime. And so it looks like we may be turning the corner on this, but we still have very high healthcare costs compared to the rest of the world, and they're still climbing.
One of the things that also is present within the law is that we have the medical loss ratio provision, which mm-hmm. means that insurance companies can't have windfall profits. If they make basically more than 20% profit or administrative costs, they have to refund part of that, which will also bring some of those costs down.
And President Obama was talking about that earlier today. We have a piece of tape that we'll try to get to here in a moment, but I want to get back to Nancy. Because it seemed to me that, Nancy, your concern is not necessarily about insurance companies, but specifically about hospitals, how much they charge. This article that you wrote that seems to be implying that they too often overcharge and that their executives get paid big bucks. Is that, in essence, what you were saying?
Yeah.
So in terms of...
It was quite enlightening. The whole issue of that Time magazine was devoted to cost.
Yeah, I'm very much aware of that issue and of the article there. I think the problem, again, though, is is trying to get some discipline over the prices that mm-hmm. hospitals charge, because right now there really isn't. People go to hospitals and they charge what they charge, and it's not like you go to a store and you see the price and you decide whether you want to buy something or not. You go to the hospital, the bill shows up later, your insurance company may try to bargain them down a bit. You're probably going to have to pay some share of it, but the whole thing is very mysterious, and it's something that that there's very little control over. And that's going to, I believe, change, and certainly in the Medicare program, there's increasing attention to trying to find ways to pay other than the more you do, the more you get, and private insurers are moving that direction as well.
Nancy, thank you so very much for your call. We also are taking questions and comments on our Facebook page, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this from Ginger, and I think this is your fault, Tim, because you do speak softly at times, and apparently she missed something that you said earlier. But let me read you her question. She said, your guest spoke about a percentage of the poverty line. What exactly is the poverty line in actual dollars, please, for an individual rather than for a family of four? And you actually gave out the individual number, but please give it again.
It's $11,490 at this point for an individual at 100% of the poverty level.
So if an individual's annual income is below $11,500, they're considered poor. They're considered below the poverty
line. Well, they're considered to be below the poverty line, yeah. I think you can probably earn more of that and still be pretty poor in this country.
Let me jump in here because I think
Could we take – I think we finally got Ham back.
Oh, okay.
I don't want to lose him again. So in Stanton, Ham, thanks for calling us. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, I got – I was wondering, for people who don't need, health care and you don't want it, is there, another option instead of, paying that fine when you come to do your taxes at the end of the year? Is there something that you could do, pay, a lower fine than – needing, because I haven't had health care since I was 18.
And how old are you now, Ham?
I am going to be 25 this year. And I don't go to doctors. The only doctor I go to is a dentist. So.
Well, what happens if you have a wreck this afternoon? Are you still going to go without health care if you're very, very seriously injured? I mean, the problem is
I'd be in God's hands, but I'm asking, what is there another option instead of getting health care? Is there a fee that you could pay that, you go to the DMV and you don't want insurance, you give them $500 and, you don't need insurance on that car.
Well, let me clarify a couple of things. There is under the law what's called an individual responsibility provision. And what that says is if you don't fit into an exemption, and there are quite a few of those, and if insurance is affordable, and affordable means that you can find a policy that costs 8% or less of your income, then you have to either buy health insurance or pay a tax. And that tax for the first year will be $95 for an individual. It will go up to $695 after 3 years. But the problem is that a couple of problems. One is you may not need health insurance right now, but we all know that tomorrow on your way home from work today, you could have a car accident and you could end up with a $100,000 hospital bill before you turned around twice. Or you could find that you have cancer. Or you could find that you've had a heart attack. Now, for young people, for people under 30, there is an option of buying a catastrophic plan, which will cost less. But the problem is that we have about $43 billion a year in bills that people run up and don't pay because they don't have health insurance. And somebody has to pay those, and it's most likely going to be everybody else.
Let me just double-check in terms of the direct answer to Ham's question of what he can do if he wants to not buy health insurance. It sounds like one of the things that you just told him is that, at least in next year, at the end of 2014, if he has not purchased health insurance, he's going to have to pay a $95 fine.
That's correct.
Which is that $95 is far, far less than what he would have paid if he purchased health insurance.
And even 3 years from then, when the fine's a little bit less than $700, won't that still amount to less than what most young people who decide not to buy health insurance would have paid even for a catastrophic, a minimal health insurance plan?
That might not actually be the case. The cost that people actually have to pay through the marketplaces is going to be the difference between what the premium is and what the tax credit is. And depending on how much you make, imagine you're a young person and maybe you wait tables at a restaurant or something along those lines, and you make $20,000 a year after your taxes, after your adjusted gross income. The cost for that person for their monthly health premium is going to be $85 a month, which is lower than most of us are paying for our cell phone bills, lower than most of us are paying for some of the other utility bills. Now, for folks who are a little bit even making less money than that, right? If you make $15,000 this coming year as an individual, which many young people do, right? Their cost per month is going to be $25, right? And if you add that across the course of a year, that's $600 for the year for folks who are probably young, single, and making very little money.
Ham, that was a great question. Thank you so much for getting us thinking about it. Washington and Lee University professor of law and specialist in health law, Tim Jost, is one of my guests this hour. Sitting next to him, University of Virginia public policy specialist Paul Martin. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you want to reach us by phone, if you have a question about anything to do with changes in federal health care and what's already been implemented as well as what's coming, 888-WMRA-TALK. 888-967-2825. We also have this from Elizabeth, who says this is on our Facebook page. And if you've just joined us, let me mention that you can reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as Virginia Insight. Okay. Elizabeth says, it's my understanding that if you are under 130%, you're not eligible for the tax credits either. So the extreme poor in Virginia are totally, I'm not going to use that word, they can't get Medicaid in VA, and they have to pay more for insurance than people that make more money. Is that correct, or am I reading it wrong?
It's pretty close. The tax credits are available for folks who make up to or above 100% of that federal poverty line. The idea was that the Medicaid expansion would cover up to 133 or 138%. There's a technical detail that's not that critical. But the writer on Facebook is basically correct that if you were to live in another state that was expanding Medicaid, you would be covered through Medicaid. But if you live in Virginia and we don't expand Medicaid and you are poor or below 100% of the poverty line, which for this coming year for a family of four,
$23,500.
Yeah, which is not that much money. So those folks are going to be out of luck until the state expands Medicaid.
And in the meantime,
and let me just, because I have such trouble with numbers, get clear on this. If somebody, the individual poverty line figure that you use, Tim Jost, is about $11,500 in annual income. You make less than that, you're considered below the poverty line. And as Paul was just saying, family of four, the poverty line is considered about $23,500. So much of this who qualifies for what is based on where somebody's income is compared to the federal poverty line.
That's right. That's correct.
So anybody who makes 133% or more of the poverty line up to a certain maximum is eligible to participate in these exchanges. Is that correct?
It's 100% to 400% in Virginia.
100%.
Yeah.
Again, it's possible that other people don't have nearly the trouble with math that I do, but I need simple steps. The people who were originally thought that they were going to be covered by Medicaid and now will not be because Virginia is not expanding Medicaid, what income levels are we talking about for those people? Do we know?
Sure. The folks who are below 100% would be the folks who are making, if you're an individual, if you, after taxes, make less than $11,490, you will not be covered by this new law until we expand Medicaid. And for a family of four, again, it's specifically the folks who are below 100% of that poverty line who are not going to be eligible for the credits. The issue is that there's a couple of pieces that you have to think about together.
And the credits are what if you have a low income, as long as it's at least a little bit above the poverty line, the federal government is going to give you help in purchasing health insurance, is going to give you tax credits.
And it's going to be significant for the folks who are closest to that lower income level. Can I just give you a couple of numbers that might be helpful? For if you are a family of four and you make collectively $30,000, what you're going to be out of pocket for in your premiums on a monthly basis is $50 a month. Now, the actual cost of that health insurance is going to be much higher, but the federal government is going to give you a pretty significant tax credit to bring your cost down to $50 a month. Now, as you get up into higher levels of income, right, you can still be within 400% of the poverty level and make between $70,000 and $90,000. But, you know, say, for example, if you make $70,000 a year and you don't have health insurance, maybe you're a consultant or something along those lines.
It's a family of four we're talking
about. For a family of four. Those people are going to pay $549 a month for their health insurance after the tax credits kick through.
And this is for somebody who doesn't currently have any health insurance.
Yeah, and this is an important piece with the marketplaces that we're talking about, is that anybody who doesn't have insurance can go to the marketplaces, but if you're rich and don't have health insurance, you're not going to get a tax credit. If you make less than 400, between 100 and 400% of the poverty line, you are going to get a tax credit.
And if you are employed and your employer currently helps pay for your health insurance, that's not changing.
That they're likely to continue to do that. And if that is the case, you're already getting a huge tax benefit because any money that an employer spends on health insurance, they don't have to pay. You don't have to pay income taxes, Social Security, Medicare, state tax. So what, in a sense, this is doing is just equalizing the situation in the United States. It's given to individuals who are uninsured tax benefits that are in some ways comparable to tax benefits that those of us who are employed have always gotten.
Tim Jost, Paul Martin, our guests. Next, we're going to Port Republic. Gene, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
Something you all said earlier led me to have an additional question. You said something about a young person with a catastrophic policy could avoid the fines, whatever, whatever. I'm 63 and a half, quit my job at age 60, promptly bought a catastrophic policy, which for 3.5 years, and, you know, I did listen a little bit to the healthcare debate, but not a lot. And I feel like I was covering my bases. Are you telling me that come October, I need to have a more robust policy in order not to be susceptible to the fine?
It would be as of January, and you need to have – I don't exactly know what you mean by a catastrophic policy. That
$5,000 deductible.
$5,000 deductible.
And then they pay everything.
Yeah. What you need to have is a bronze plan to comply with the requirements. Now, you may be eligible for a catastrophic policy if insurance is otherwise unaffordable. But a bronze policy is a pretty high deductible policy. I'm not sure if it would be $5,000.
So at this point in time, and Gene, we're going to keep you on the line in case we can come up with even more specifics as I see Paul flipping through some pages he's got in front of him. But it sounds like the basic answer is you're close. We don't know for sure if you're right where you need to be, but maybe we can find the answer when we get back in a bit more than 1 minute. Looking at the latest twists and turns in healthcare reform across the U.S. and specifically in Virginia, we have phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Our guests, Tim Jost, attorney and professor of health law at Washington and Lee University, as well as Paul Martin, political scientist and faculty member in the University of Virginia's Batten School of Public Policy, as well as one of the founders of a new organization that calls itself the Greater Charlottesville Community Health Coalition.
This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So we were getting into some specifics that may be impossible to answer, but we've still got Gene in Port Republic on the line, who's concerned that at age 63, with a policy that is sometimes referred to as a catastrophic policy, it pretty much only covers big emergencies. He has a $5,000 deductible. He's wondering if that deductible is so big that the federal government's not going to be happy that he doesn't have enough coverage as of next year?
Okay. Just to give a little bit more complete answer, a catastrophic policy under the statute is defined as, I think it's like a $10,000 or $11,000, $12,000 deductible policy. So that would be a much bigger catastrophe than you're looking at. In terms of what the law requires, it requires that a person purchase a 60% actuarial value plan if it is affordable, which is to say if you can find one for 8% or less of your income. Now, it's a little bit hard to say exactly what a 60% actuarial value plan will look like, but it's going to be a pretty high deductible plan, particularly if it doesn't have coinsurance or copayments above that. And I would guess it'll be several thousand dollars. What it'll be, $5,000 exactly, I don't know. The other bit of information, though, that's going to be relevant to you is that the Affordable Care Act only allows a 1-to-3 spread in age rating between youngest and oldest people. And insurance companies right now often charge 5 or 6 times as much for a person who's 63 than they charge for a 21-year-old. So for older people like you and me, insurance premiums are probably going to come down, even though the coverage may be a little bit more generous. Of course, the other side of that is that for a young person who doesn't have coverage through their parents' policy or who doesn't get the premium tax credits that Paul was talking about because their incomes are too high, they're probably going to be looking at a little higher premiums for the same coverage.
Gene, does that help?
Well, yes, and you almost answered what originally was going to be my first question, which was, when I quit my job, 3 or 4 friends counseled me, make sure you get some kind of a policy, catastrophic, whatever, so that you're covered, and I pretty much thought that myself. And these friends all said that in Virginia, about all that I was going to have available in a private plan, was one company. I don't guess there's any need to mention its name. My original question was going to be, with the advent of the marketplace, the exchange, however you wish to phrase it, here in Virginia, and I know different states are either being cooperative or less so, do you foresee price competition improving? In other words, does it pay me to get back into the marketplace to see if I can find a better deal than I'm getting now?
This is Paul Martin.
I would definitely encourage you to look, right? Because it'll be pretty easy for you to go online, look at the marketplace, and see whether you can find an insurance that it's going to be cheaper than the one that you're paying. But the state of Virginia decided not to set up its own marketplace. So our marketplace is going to be set up by the federal government. And the same is going to be true for many states that elected not to set up their own marketplaces. And there's going to be, I think right now there's a minimum of 2 insurance companies in the marketplace, and I believe as time folds out, there's going to be several more that people are going to be able to choose from. Tim might have more information about the specifics.
Yeah, there are. I don't have the exact number, but I know that there are a number of insurance companies in Virginia that will be offering coverage, and there definitely will be price competition. And the other thing that's probably most important is they cannot exclude pre-existing conditions or people with pre-existing conditions. So, one problem that a lot of people have right now is that they are locked into their job, they are locked into their insurer, because if they try to change, most importantly, if they decide to quit their job and become an entrepreneur and start up a new company or something else, they can't get health insurance. And so it's not only that there will be more choices, that there will be price competition, but also that people can freely move and they don't have to worry about the fact that they already have some health problems.
The caller's story reminds me of my mother-in-law, who stayed in a job that she loathed up until the point that she was 65, because otherwise she would be fearful for not having insurance. And starting next year, once these marketplaces are open, people who are unhappy in their employment situation won't have to stay specifically in that job. They will be able to find new jobs or other jobs that they might be interested in, and they won't be facing that real risk of not having health insurance.
Gene, you asked two questions, and you got us talking what feels like dozens or at least a dozen different important topics. So thanks for sparking so much here on Virginia Insight. We're going to go next to Finn Castle and talk to Alice. Alice, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for healthcare specialists Tim Jost and Paul Martin, at least in terms of health policy.
Hi. My question is earlier in the show, I think it was Professor Jost, said that as we lead into the healthcare bill going into effect in 2014 for the most part, that healthcare costs are already starting to fall in the United States. And my question is, couldn't that also be due to the fact that during 2007 to 2009, moving into 2010, the economy was in what we call the Great Recession, and so aggregate demand was quite low, driving prices and quantities down. Couldn't that also be one of the reasons why healthcare costs were falling over the past years in the United States?
Absolutely, and that's probably the biggest reason why. That and the fact that millions of people lost their jobs and therefore lost their health insurance. The problem is, though, is that all that was going on? And there have been a number of studies that suggests that, no, that's not all that's going on. What's also going on is, and this is probably a smaller part of it, is that the healthcare system is reorganizing and is doing that in some ways that are bringing down cost. The other thing is that insurance companies have, and I follow insurance companies quite closely because I'm a consumer representative of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, have been predicting for a couple of years now that, okay, the recession's over, costs are going to go shooting right back up again. And for some reason, they haven't. I think the recession is a very big part of it, but I don't think it's all that's going on. And I just want to clarify, nobody thinks healthcare costs are going to go down in absolute terms. What is going down is the rate of increase, but that in itself is very encouraging.
Alice, thank you so much for joining us here on Virginia Insight. I'm going to stretch my memory here. Tim Jost, tell me, if you would, how far off I am. Your book, Healthcare at Risk, that compares what has been going on for the past few decades in the U.S. healthcare system and what happens in many other industrialized parts of the world, was actually published before the Affordable Care Act was passed. But I think some of the numbers that you talk about are still fairly close today. And if I recall correctly, one of the things that you pointed out in that book was that on a per capita basis, in terms of total amount spent annually on health care, in the U.S., it's somewhere close to 17%. And in most industrialized countries, it's more like 9 or 10%.
That's correct.
So when you compare what we're doing in spending on healthcare, it's almost twice as much, or at least 70 or 80% more than the average other industrialized nation. And yet all of those countries have some form of universal healthcare. And at the time your book was written, we did not even have Obamacare.
That's correct. And also, I've lived in other countries and had quite a bit of experience with other countries' healthcare systems. And even though they are less expensive, at least the countries I've lived in have had very high-quality healthcare systems, and comparable to ours, in some ways better, in some ways probably not as good. So it's not that we're spending so much more and we're getting so much more for our money. We're spending so much more, and we aren't really.
Paul Martin, let's talk a little bit about the Greater Charlottesville Community Health Coalition. Do I understand correctly that one of the reasons you helped get this started in recent months is because of a concern that people who are the working poor may not know where they can go for help or what's being made available to them over the next few months?
That one of the main goals of this organization, and it's a coalition of a few nonprofits, and we're growing hopefully every day, is that anytime you roll out a significant piece of policy, the implementation is hard. And it's hard on people. It's difficult to get people signed up, even for benefits that they're highly eligible for. We know this is true for, say, for example, what used to be called the food stamp program, now called the SNAP program for lower-income folks. It's not subscribed to at the rate that people are eligible for it. And we wanted to proactively lower the cost for people to get health insurance through
this
law. So
what are you doing?
What are we doing? Right now, we're pretty much at a coalition building stage. We're gathering the organizations in town that normally have access to populations that we think are going to be impacted by this law, and trying to coordinate a set of public service announcements, education campaigns, and the ultimate goal is that come October, we'll be able to help people physically enroll in this law. It's going to require a tremendous amount of volunteer work, and it's going to require a lot of dedicated staff time from a number of organizations. But one of the most significant pieces of this law is that there currently is not a large reservoir of money available for implementation. And organizations like the one that we put together in Charlottesville are going to help limit how difficult it is for people to sign up for this law.
We have this from Ellen on our Facebook page, who says, Virginia's decision not to participate in the Medicaid expansion can only be described as heartless and unconscionable. There is absolutely no excuse other than a disregard for the citizens of the Commonwealth. I hope everyone is paying attention.
Let me.
I'm not a conservative, but sometimes I play one on the radio. And since we haven't yet had anyone speak up for the legislators and the governor who made the decision not to accept the federal funds for expanding Medicaid, it at least needs to be mentioned, I think, that their point of view, their argument was, sure, for the first 3 years, we get this increase paid for by the federal government 100%, but then it begins to drop. And even though the federal government says that we're never going to have to pay more than 10%, we don't know for sure what's going to happen, but we would be obligated to pay out of our budget so many more millions of dollars that we don't have.
Well, there are a number of responses to that. The first is, as of January 1st, we're losing, I believe, about $2 million a day by not signing up for the Medicaid expansion. California's expanding. New York's expanding. Tax dollars are going to be flowing out of Virginia, federal tax dollars, to pay for Medicaid expansion in other states. So we might as well do it here. We're talking about 300,000 low-income Virginians who are not going to get covered. We're talking about billions of dollars that healthcare providers in Virginia are not going to be getting. We're talking about, I think, 20 to 30,000 jobs that we're not going to be creating in Virginia. And we're talking actually about, in the long range, the state losing money, because even though eventually we will have to pay 10%, it means that some costs that Virginia is already paying for are now going to be covered by Medicaid. And also that we're going to have increased tax revenues in Virginia because of the increased spending through the Medicaid program. So I just don't think that's a valid argument. As far as is the federal government going to renege on its promise? Well, I guess that depends on who is in charge of running the country. I can imagine that we could elect a Congress in this country that would repeal the whole thing, and then the state would not anymore get the federal share. But HHS has already said, and I think this follows from the Supreme Court opinion, that if a state wants to withdraw at some point, it can withdraw. And I think that the state Senate understood this. Senator Hanger has been given tremendous leadership in moving this forward.
So one of the things that should be mentioned is that the idea for expanding Medicaid in Virginia is not dead. There was a compromise between the Republicans, which Senator Hanger is one of, and the Democrats in the state legislature, who were in the minority but wanted the move to expand Medicaid. That they put together a commission that's going to study the issue, and it might be sometime
the middle of next year that they decide to accept the Medicaid expansion?
I think it's more accurate to describe it as a compromise between the House and the Senate, both of which are dominated by Republicans, because the Senate voted to move forward, the House voted to delay.
I apologize if I put it wrong, Tim, but I guess the basic point is that the issue is not dead in the water.
Absolutely not.
That there is still possibility that Medicaid could be expanded.
And they've laid down conditions that need to be met. They're I think, reasonable conditions, and HHS is working with the state to get those met.
You know, whenever you're in the studio, I lose track of time. And now we're out of time. Our guests have been Paul Martin, faculty member and director of professional services at the University of Virginia's Batten School of Public Policy, as well as founding member of the new Greater Charlottesville Community Health Coalition. Sitting next to him, Tim Jost, professor of health law at Washington and Lee University and author of the book Health Care at Risk. Tim, Paul, thank you both so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Virginia Insights executive producer, Matt Bingay. Associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Now, you can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs and clicking on Virginia Insight. And the advantage is, if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about both of our guests and the work that they're doing. And of course, if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, you get a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.